Hey, happy Friday. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. This is the Week in Review, and we're joined today by Cairo 7 reporter Essex Porter, former King County executive Ron Sims, and Seattle writer Katie Anthony. She writes for CNN and NBC News, and she's the co-host of Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory, a podcast about feminism, family, and other F-words. This week, Seattle business owner Dave Meinert has been accused of sexual abuse and rape by five women. He's the owner of several small businesses in the city, including the Five Point Cafe. Dave Meinert was one of the creators of the Capitol Hill Block Party. He's been an influential member of the Seattle business, music, and political community. KUOW's Sydney Brownstone broke the story yesterday afternoon. If you haven't seen it yet, I encourage you to read her full account at kuow.org. Sydney joins us now. These allegations go back to 2001. Why are we hearing from these women now, Sydney?
Well, Ross, first of all, this story took months to report, and I didn't find all of the women at once, so it took me several months to find all five. But also, many of them weren't motivated to report the allegations or speak out until they heard about Bill Cosby or Harvey Weinstein. It didn't occur to them that what allegedly happened to them may have been sexual assault.
At least one of the women did contact law enforcement, and how did they deal with the situation?
Yes, so two women contacted law enforcement. The first reported her alleged rape around the time she said it occurred, and prosecutors declined to file charges. Meinert wasn't even interviewed. The reason why, according to the prosecutor's decline memo, was that she did not express a clear lack of consent. She said no in a lot of different ways, according to the prosecutor's report, trying to squirm away, giving various excuses, but it wasn't firm enough. And the other one reported 4 years after she said she was sexually assaulted. And by that time, it was past the statute of limitations.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Are any of these alleged cases of sexual assault and rape still prosecutable? Or are they all out of the range of time to do that?
I don't think, to my knowledge, none of them are currently prosecutable.
You interviewed Dave Meinert for this story, and here's part of what he said to you about these allegations.
I think that the Me Too movement has pointed out how widespread and grotesque of a situation we have with how men have treated women for thousands of years, and that includes me. I think that I have crossed the line of respect. I think that I've been pushy or handsy, which we might have called it in the past, but now looking back, it's more than that, and it's an invasion, and it crosses the line.
Local businessman Dave Meinert responding to accusations of sexual assault and rape. Have any of the women you talked to, Sydney, responded to what Dave Meinert told you in that interview? It's been up on the web now for about a day.
Yes, they have, and I wanted to add something to your yes. earlier question about why we're hearing from these women now. One of the reasons, two of the women responded specifically to a post that Meinert had made on the Me Too movement. He said that he was full of self-reflection and self-contemplation, and they were motivated by that. That made them extremely angry. In my interview with Meinert, he either denied the specific allegations of sexual assault and rape, or he said that he couldn't recall some of the instances of inappropriate behavior. In one of the allegations, the woman said that he choked her and sexually assaulted her, and he said that they had consensual sex. She was extremely angered by that, and she said, no, that's not true. It's disgusting. So I think some of the women were shocked, or that's how they presented it to me. Some of them were emboldened by hearing his response. I think it's interesting that the police didn't interview him at the time of one of the alleged rapes. So I think it was actually really helpful to hear from him.
As you mentioned, when these stories come out, they often prompt more reaction from people. What have you been hearing from the public since the story went online?
I've been really surprised by the reaction that I've seen thus far. I've been getting a lot of really supportive messages. When the news broke about Mayor Ed Murray, for example, the reaction was much more mixed, and I'm not sure the reaction today would be what it is if the city hadn't experienced what it had with the former mayor.
I wanted to talk about this with our panelists, your reflections on it, but first of all, did any of you have any questions for Sydney about this story that we've talked about very briefly here? And I strongly recommend that you check out the website. There's a whole lot more to this that we're not getting into.
Hi, Sydney. Hey. Thank you so much for this article. As I was reading it, I was struck by how responsibly reported it was and how ethically reported it was.
Thank you.
And I was just wondering, as you were going through the process of developing this story, what kind of your mindset was in terms of having kind of a cultural responsibility and knowing the legacy of, you know, the flaws in the reporting on sexual violence in the past, you know, how did that color kind of the way you proceeded in developing this story?
Absolutely. That's a really, really good question, because anytime I report on sexual assault, the University of Virginia Rolling Stone story looms very large in my mind.
And of course, in that case, the Rolling Stone completely blew the story and used manufactured information.
They did. Yeah. The risk of getting anything wrong is extremely high. For the accusers, for the accused, for the publication that I would be writing for. And as a former fact checker, I'm already kind of anal retentive about facts, but I think the weight and the intensity and the sensitivity of these stories just takes it to another level. And I would not have tried to publish this story if I wasn't sure about my facts going in.
Essex Porter, you're in a newsroom and you probably hear stories, and it's a question of when they raise to the level of something that you're going to pursue and put out there on television. Has that kind of calculation changed as we've gone into the Me Too movement?
Well, I think one thing that has changed about it is that we tell ourselves and we say out loud to ourselves that we should start from a point of believing accusers, at least taking them seriously enough to check and not dismissing accusers out of hand because they may have mixed records. In the Ed Murray case, the accusers had committed petty crimes. They had substance abuse addictions. It made them easier to dismiss a decade ago. We would not just dismiss out of hand without checking a serious allegation now.
Ron Sims, what are your reflections on this story? Sad to say, it's not a surprise to hear that another powerful man has been accused of these horrible issues. But what are your thoughts?
I have nothing but substantial distaste for rapists. You can't excuse the conduct. You can't explain the conduct. You can't justify the conduct. You can't rationalize the conduct. The phrase that we use is low life. I don't care how much money they make or how popular they are. They just are distasteful human beings.
And it's worth saying Dave Minard has denied the charges of rape. But Katie Anthony, you've talked about something you've called the spectrum of hostility. And that kind of relates to what is said by these folks, right?
Exactly. I think a lot of people would agree with you that rape is unacceptable. There's no conversation around it. There's no debate around it. It's absolutely unacceptable. In 2018, anywhere on this earth, it's not okay. The issue that we get a lot of the time is that people will say, like, well, I am against rape, therefore I am an ally for women. And that there's a huge gap between saying, like, well, I don't rape people or I'm against rape, and saying I'm actually understanding the full spectrum of hostility that women experience.
It's kind of a low bar, isn't it?
It is. It is. Like, okay, good for you. What else are you? You're also not a, you know, dog torturer. Well, that's great. Definitely keep that in your life. But there are other things you can do also, right? And it's really important to notice that, you know, the seed of hostility that will eventually grow into really egregious sexual violence against women can also be expressed in lots of different ways that feel invisible to people who have maybe never experienced them. And these are behaviors that are often described as being handsy or being a little grabby or a little aggressive. There's another word for that, and it's assault. And even though we're all more comfortable not defining that as assault, those behaviors exist on this spectrum where no matter if you're whispering it with a little, you know, a little pinch as she walks by, or shouting it by forcibly, you know, engaging in sex without her consent, the underlying concept is the same, which is you don't get to control your body. Whatever I want, I can have with or without your consent.
And handsy is the exact word Dave Meinert used in that statement that we just heard.
Exactly. And I would like to just go on and say that entitlement to women's space, you can also see in his response to being identified by these women when he's texting a woman that he has assaulted and saying, well, now I'm ready to be taught. Now I'm ready to grow. Help me grow. You are not entitled to her time and energy. You're not entitled for her to use her trauma to help you become a better person. That's your work that you need to be responsible for. And the fact that he, you know, even had the idea like, oh, I should reach out to her. She can help me be a better man. Like, check that idea in your head. Where do you feel like people just exist to help you be your best self?
I'm out of a culture, though, African-American culture,
yes,
where it's hard to grow up and not know black women that were raped.
Hmm.
And nobody gave a doggone.
Mm-hmm.
I have pretty strong feelings about that. It's not just the injustice of it. It is the sense that it was allowable, it was okay. So I think that what we're seeing now is far more light being shed on it. And I'm glad that we have people saying it is unacceptable. But when I grew up as a kid, oh wow, if you raped the black women, no one cared except for us in the black community who would say, you did what? Why is that person being held accountable? And it isn't handsy, it isn't okay, it isn't just, you know, burning the oats. I mean, all these phrases that justified it. So to me, it is like this has been a long time coming, and I am glad that now people are finding how repulsive it is, because I'm out of a culture that had to accept it for a heck of a long time, and no one cared. Mm-hmm. And now people are raising their voices, and I am so happy to see this happen.
Essex, you had something to add.
Yeah, I actually had a question about the reporting of the story. When I read the story last night, then looked online, there was an exchange about perhaps polygraph tests that Meinert had taken. I just wondered if you could expand any more on that.
Sure. So Meinert's strategist forwarded polygraph tests that were taken by Meinert at the time of his 2007 accusation. And those were not conducted by police. Those came about as the result of some of the work his defense attorney was doing at the time. And they asked questions about whether the accuser had performed oral sex on him without a word and some of the conversations they had in the car. But the questions were not, did you rape or did you sexually assault someone in the bathroom, which was the accusation that she was actually making. So, to see, yes,
right.
That's
right, and it's because of polygraph measures your physiological reactions. If you believe you're telling the truth, it may believe you're telling the truth even if you're not.
That yes, that's true. And I have no reason to think. I mean, Meinert may very well believe that he's telling the truth. That's a possibility.
You know, it sounds as though there still might be legal ramifications. We don't know about that yet. Some of these things may have gone past the deadlines, but there are always social ramifications when these accusations come forward. Awards are revoked, contracts are canceled, et cetera, et cetera. Is there anything, have you picked up any kind of intelligence on what kind of ramifications this might have for Dave Meinert, a local businessman, very prominent in the community, very active in politics?
I have to wonder. I presume I did not check. I presume he's donated to politicians in the past. I have to wonder if now those politicians might look at this and decide that they want to donate those donations as others in similar situations have donated such donations to nonprofits who help sexual assault victims. So maybe there will be something like that.
We shall see. Sidney Brownstone, thank you so much for telling us about this story, and I strongly recommend you read it. We just barely covered the surface. There's much more detail on it at kuow.org. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. You're listening to Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke, with our panelists this week, Essex Porter from Cairo TV, former King County Executive Ron Sims, and Katie Anthony. She writes for CNN and NBC News. Mayor Jenny Durkan made a big announcement this week.
I have no question the Chief Carmen Best is the person to lead the police department to the next level in the city of Seattle. She will be our next chief of police. She has earned this through hard work, dedication, and service. She will work her heart out, and I believe she will make our city proud.
Mayor Jenny Durkan announcing her choice of Carmen Best as police chief. I want to get your reaction to this choice in a moment, but first of all, how we got here. It was just a few weeks ago that Carmen Best was not in consideration. She was not one of the three finalists for the job. One candidate backed out and Carmen Best was back in, and then Tuesday she got the nod from Mayor Durkan. What happened, Essex Porter?
You know, I'm going to actually defer to Mr. Sims here, who was, involved in the search. I mean, what happened?
And you can explain your role in this, Ron.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in the search. There was two different groups. You had a search committee, and then in the end, they had what I call evaluators. And our evaluation process was to determine that everybody was evaluated the same way. So it wasn't an issue of preference. It was the issue of kind of rules. Was everybody interviewed? Were their backgrounds done? It was more that than actually being in the selection process itself.
Yeah. Well, what was a little bit weird about this was that there was a, as I understand it, a group that came up with three finalists. They were not, did not include Carmen Best. And to what degree that group was influenced by what the mayor wanted? Did the mayor reverse herself by bringing Carmen Best into the process? What do you know about that, Ron Sims?
I have no idea. All I know is that I was asked to be on a call the day before the announcement.
The day before the original announcement?
No, day before this last one.
Oh, the day before the last announcement.
And where one could speak candidly. She was added back on the list.
And were you okay with that? Did you like that? Did she been added back on?
I was ecstatic. When years ago, when Ed Murray first asked Pramila Jayapal and I to chair his committee to select a new chief, we ended up with two finalists, and Catherine O'Toole became the chief. One of the reasons why we liked her so much is she said she was only going to be there for 4 years. But whoever was her deputy would be the person, she would give them assignments over 4 years that would make it absolutely certain, in her opinion, that that individual was capable of being Seattle's police chief. And I'll never forget all the assignments that Carmen was given by Chief O'Toole. And so, you know, I don't know what all the other dynamics were in the process because I was not privy. I was not on the search committee. But I was utterly ecstatic. I cannot tell you how happy I was. And let me tell you bluntly why. She was an African-American woman who worked from the within the department up to get respect and was all involved in the community. And when she wasn't on even the finalist list, I was pretty stunned. I said, well, this is a liberal town, and we're not going to consider an African-American woman who's already chief as part of the finalist to look at. I mean, that was it soured me on liberalism because
sure.
I said, wow, you know, everybody's liberal until it comes to black people.
But to be fair, the knock on her was there's a lot of reform that still needs to be sustained within the Seattle Police Department. And the question was, could someone who's been a 25-year veteran of that department enact that with the connections that she has, with the respect she has within the department, inhibit her from doing what needs to be done to continue those reforms to reduce the use of unnecessary use of force?
That's a question. But what anybody in leadership has been able to see in action was Carmen Best doing that job.
Yeah.
Sometimes disciplining police officers, sometimes standing by police officers. They looked at her as an insider. But I think what they may have forgotten is she was not just an insider for the police department. She was an insider in multiple communities in Seattle, who felt that their insider, someone who had supported them, someone who had been at their vigils,
right,
someone who had been with them when they were angry and tried to help, was being rejected. So she was an insider in two ways. And they, to me, I think, neglected the other way she was an insider, which was even more important.
Assuming Carmen Best is confirmed as police chief by the city council, and from what I understand, it appears to be a lock, how are we going to judge this choice in a year or two? How are we going to stand back and say, this was a good choice, Carmen Best has fulfilled our expectations of what a police chief does? Is it
here's what I'll be looking for. Yeah. Because policing is inherently risky. Something will go wrong despite Chief Best's best efforts, the best efforts of sergeants and lieutenants and assistant chiefs. Something will go wrong. How will they handle that? And I'll also be looking to see if the community that was so strong in supporting Chief Best will be at her side, as the mayor pointed out at our news conference, will be at her side when things get hard.
Right.
That's, I think, how we'll judge it in a year. We'll also be looking to the federal judge as he continues to monitor this. And if he continues to say that things are progressing in the right direction, that'll be another data point.
Katie Anthony, your thoughts on the selection of Carmen Best?
I totally agree with Essex, and I think that's such an incredibly important point, that she's not just a member of a police community, she's also a member of her local community here in Seattle. It feels like we're really at a cultural flashpoint where it comes to police accountability and gun violence and right to protest. And this is such a strong pick because Carmen Best is more than just a veteran of this police force. She is also someone who's really already put her boots on the ground, and she's drawn a line in the sand and said there are going to be actionable consequences for excessive force. There's going to be a standard of integrity to which our officers are held. And she's already there. And I thought, as I was thinking about this, about something that Ijeoma Oluo wrote in Medium after the two men were arrested in the Philadelphia Starbucks. Her piece is called On Starbucks and Corporate Accountability for Racial Bias. She wrote, "Hearts and minds matter less than rules and consequences. No matter what bigotries people may have, what they do or do not do at work is largely dictated by what they are expected to do and what they know that they cannot do without facing real consequences." And already we're seeing that system is being put into place by a woman who must understand that intimately.
But I also have to say this. Mayor Durkin did something that was very uncommon for elected officials. She basically said, you know, I already have a great chief. And even though that chief is not on the finalist list, she's going to be my chief. Mm-hmm. She hasn't got her shout outs, as I would call them, for basically saying, you know, I'm uncomfortable and I want her to be my chief. And she stepped forward and did that. And people can second guess her till the cows come home. That what I am glad is that it makes her different from most elected officials who would have just let things happen. And she decided to say, no, I'm not going to let this happen. Carmen's going to be my chief. And I'm happy for the city, but I really love the mayor's courage and her decision-making. That has to be applauded.
It's Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds. With us, King County Executive Ron Sims, who you just heard from, Katie Anthony, who writes for CNN and NBC News, and Essex Porter from Cairo TV. Coming up, a streetcar named Cost Overrun. This is the Week in Review on KUOW. Well, Seattle has a South Lake Union streetcar. Seattle has a First Hill streetcar, but those lines don't connect. The downtown streetcar line is supposed to fix that, but cost overruns have prompted Mayor Durkin to put the brakes on construction. Among the problems, the new streetcars are designed as longer and heavier than the current ones. They won't fit into the maintenance barns, and they may not fit the gauge of the rail that's already established. Meanwhile, business owners are agitating to get construction restarted. They feel as though this could really be a boost to them, and the continuing construction going on could really harm them. Essex, you've been covering this. I got to say, I'm a little shocked to hear that the streetcars won't fit into the maintenance barns. It seems like that would be one of the first things you would do.
It reminds me, and Ron Sims here is laughing because he knows I remember that's exactly the same thing that happened on light rail, that the rails that were put in the tunnel they were just slapped in the tunnel to pretend we were going to have trains. When it actually came down to the actual light rail,
that's right, I remember that.
The actual trains, Ron Sims, as county executive, had to come to reporters like me and take tough questions about why you have to rip up the rails put in years ago and put in rails that will actually work for light rail. So,
And we've done it again. I mean, in recent memory, the same problem, and it's happened again. How does that happen? Ron Sims, I'm going to ask you. You're someone who's been in government and had to deal with these things. How does government get something this wrong?
I have no idea. I mean, what happens is you assume that you have professionals in play who are understanding the consequences of their decisions. And somehow that has to bubble up. Now, if you hear about it and then can react, that's one thing. If you heard about it and didn't react, got to say about the mayor, she heard about it and stopped it and said, hold it a second.
Yeah.
And that's really important. And one can't, that was a really smart decision. For those of us who have gone through being surprised that a decision went awry and all of a sudden you're looking at something being more costly, to be able to see a person anticipate that cost growth and put the brakes on was really important. And I've got a plotter on that. I can't explain how you could ever get rail car, especially after our experience, how you could get a trolley that wouldn't fit in the barn. I mean, somebody should have said something a long time ago, because it's not something that you just learned about.
Right.
Somebody did a workaround, and you want to say you worked around not getting the trolley in the barn?
Yeah, and in fairness, the mayor's probably not looking at those kind of issues, but she's at a higher level. The mayor, Durkin, did say she was going to review this downtown connector streetcar, but that review is kind of quite overdue, is it not, Essex?
The review, is overdue from the time that they said they would have it. They are apparently still going through it, and they will be looking at what the consequences are when they ultimately publish the numbers. You know, will they make a decision that goes along with the numbers, or will they have to explain why they're making a decision that doesn't go along with the numbers? You know, there are equity issues here with this streetcar. There are transportations here with this streetcar. Right now, you have a streetcar network that is in two parts that are not connected. That doesn't seem to be very smart. It turns out that it's going to be much more expensive than anybody thought to connect the middle section. But does that mean the middle section shouldn't be connected? I saw online people reminding us that when the streetcar was built through Chinatown International District, there was a lot of disruption to people and businesses there. And the district was said, please hang on, this will be great because you'll ultimately be connected to downtown. So will they get that downtown connection? And I know city council members, because I've heard them say so, are concerned about spending so much money on downtown, one of the wealthier parts of the city, when there is so much that needs to be spent on transportation for other far less wealthy parts of the city.
Katie, Anthony, I've heard some people saying the mayor should just pull the plug on this. Is that even possible to consider now that we've already built two streetcars that are not connected? We're going to just have to bite the bullet and pay what we have to pay, which we already know is tens of millions of dollars more than we expected.
Well, I have to say, I agree with Ron that I think the mayor did absolutely the right thing in saying, like, okay, stop. I often think about this when I'm in line at, like, Target or the grocery store, and I'm in the slow line, and a new line opens up, and I have this moment of, like, well, I've been in this line for so long, I should just stay in this line. But you have to remind yourself that time is gone. The time and money that has been spent on this already is gone, and we have to make a decision today with the information that we have today, or hopefully will have in the near future. And it should not be understated the importance of access for people for whom public transportation is a daily necessity. It would have to be, and there's so many factors to consider here, particularly as the city is, you know, recovering from the head tax trauma that it just is still reeling from. You know, the longer this project sits, even having been stopped responsibly, the longer it sits in limbo, the more damage it's doing to budgets, the more damage it's doing to the, you know, effective relationships between businesses and the government. We got to do it.
Well, we should hear more about this maybe in a matter of weeks, but we're going to be talking about it for a lot longer than that as this issue of the downtown connector streetcar continues. It's the Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. With us, Katie Anthony, Ron Sims, and Essex Porter. Stick around. It's Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke with our panelists, Essex Porter from Cairo TV, Katie Anthony, a Seattle writer for CNN and NBC News, and former King County executive Ron Sims. In an interview this week, Mark Zuckerberg defended keeping Holocaust deniers on Facebook.
At the end of the day, I don't believe that our platform should take that down because I think that there are things that different people get wrong, either... I don't think that they're intentionally getting it wrong, but I think that they...
In the case of a Holocaust deniers, they might be, but go ahead.
It's hard to impugn intent and to understand the intent. Mm-hmm. But I just think for as abhorrent as some of those examples are, I think the reality is also that I get things wrong when I speak publicly. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you do. I'm sure a lot of leaders and public figures who we respect do too. And I just don't think that it is the right thing to say we are going to take someone off the platform if they get things wrong, even multiple times.
Katie, what do you make of Zuckerberg's defense of having Holocaust deniers on Facebook? Because they don't know that they're wrong about the Holocaust. They don't. They're just mistaken about 6 million deaths.
Yeah. No, I mean, all you have to do is talk to, you know, a screaming liberal like me for like 10 seconds, and you will hear someone say, "Your intention is less important than your impact." Like, 15 or 20 times. So the intention of people is to tell the truth about the Holocaust. Yeah, but that's not what you're doing. What you're doing is you're lying. And if Facebook is going to continue to claim to be committed to eradicating fake news from its website, as it has been saying, then it doesn't matter if the fake news is happening today or if the fake news happened in the 1940s. It's fake. It's a lie. There are not two sides to this story. There is the truth side and the lie side. This is not a matter of opinion. And when I hear him saying, you know, like, I personally find Holocaust denial very offensive. He's a Jewish man. He finds it extremely personally offensive. And yet you are in a position to allow or disallow that narrative to gain ground on your platform. And so when he's saying like, well, I don't personally agree with it, but you allow it to take root and you allow it to legitimize a debate about whether the Holocaust happened, you know, it's what he says doesn't matter because what he's doing is enabling it.
Essex Porter, what do you think, first of all, about Zuckerberg's defense of having Holocaust deniers on Facebook?
It's lame.
You think they should take them down?
I think they should. Yes, I think they should take down the pages that deny the Holocaust. But I think more importantly, even as important, Zuckerberg still doesn't seem to get the fact that Facebook is a media platform that needs to be edited. It is not just a white wall for people to spray up their graffiti. Facebook can be life and death to people. You know, if CNN, Fox, MSNBC consistently allowed what we see on Facebook, there would be incredible outrage if they consistently allowed things that could get people killed, the broadcast 24 hours a day.
That's a really important point. I think if you're a Holocaust denier, you have perhaps a First Amendment right to go somewhere and demonstrate and express your views. Facebook is not a government agency. It's a private company, and they have the ability to police their site and the speech on their site. What do you think, Ron Sims, about should Facebook allow Holocaust deniers on their site?
No, they shouldn't. It's anti-Semitic. I'll be blunt. I mean, we're not talking about people who are in search of the of an answer. They are anti-Semitic.
I thought his reliance on intent. They're mistaken in that. So it seems as though Mark Zuckerberg is looking into their souls and kind of figuring out what their kind of internal process is, which seems to me to be an impossible thing to do. Anyone who spreads false information through any forum could say, I sincerely believe that, but it's hard to figure out whether they're just gaming it.
If there was a site that said black people were never enslaved, I think a lot of people would take offense. So when you say that there was not a Holocaust, I think people can rightfully say not only is it offensive, it's inaccurate, and it's not. And the issue is whether he wishes to allow that kind of totality of free expression, even if it is the embodiment, or you have a group of people trying to create a movement, and it's a hateful movement. We're not talking about love or accuracy of information or opinion. This is just pure hate.
Okay, Holocaust deniers, it sounds like you're agreed that they should not be on Facebook. But there are so many issues like this about free speech versus censorship, issues that will harm people, views that will be offensive to people, and the ability to express them. And granted, as I say, Facebook is not government. Facebook is a private site. They can do whatever they want to. Are there any other issues like that that you think of where you go, this is a little closer to the line and I'm not sure about? A question of something that maybe you're not exactly sure whether Facebook should take it off or not. Are there other calls that are less easy to make than Holocaust deniers?
I'm like holding my breath trying to get my thoughts organized right now, because I think Essex's point is so critical to this debate, which is that Facebook is a media company. Facebook wants to be a tech company because a tech company is not necessarily responsible for the content that appears on its page. But a media company, if they start to moderate the content really intensely, all of a sudden they can be held liable for acts of violence that are perpetrated as a result of hate speech that they allow to exist on their platform. And Facebook is now a heavily monetized platform, and so there are dollars at play here. I think there are a lot of instances where you'll see activists' accounts being suspended for alleged hate speech. One that I have seen happen many, many, many times, because I'm in a number of different anti-racism communities on Facebook. I know a lot of the leaders of those communities have multiple accounts because they're often getting their accounts suspended for saying for publishing posts that have the term white people in it. And people who are angry about what these activists have said will report to Facebook that, you know, someone said like, oh, it sounds like white people white peopling, and that is counted as hate speech and someone's account gets suspended.
That's taken down.
It's taken down.
But a Holocaust denier, not taken down.
It's absolutely not taken down. And what I find so, so irresponsible about this platform is that Zuckerberg is saying like, oh, well, we're not going to let violent content exist. Well, what is your definition of violence? Is diminishing someone's personhood violent? Is lying about the death of 6 million human beings, is that violent to you? Because it's violent to me. And so if you're not going to expand your definition of violence to understand how the spoken word or the written word can be a weapon, you have no business in the media.
You hit the nail on the head when you talked about the difference between a tech company and a media company, because all of internet law basically holds those who are simply having people share information on their site harmless for what is said. But as soon as you begin to edit it, as soon as you jump in and say something, you are kind of in a different area. Other thoughts on this?
No, I agree. You know, I have people who comment on my Facebook site who I disagree with it. I don't mind discussion and differences of opinion. But there is a line that I think you can't cross, and that is if you are marketing or your purpose is to create hate. That should be distasteful and unacceptable. And the Holocaust denier sites, that to me, I don't know how else you would explain people who had got up and said it didn't happen. What purpose is served? Other than I think one where, I mean, it's not stupidity. It is intent, so that we can deny it, so that we can say it is overplayed and this really didn't happen and Nazism was okay. I mean, there's a whole series of logical outcomes to these sites that I think we don't, that maybe they should go to their own sites, but I think Facebook, because it it is a site that they're asking a lot of people to communicate their opinions on, yeah. I think there should be some standard. Maybe that's the phrase I'm using.
We're going to move on, but maybe you've got some reactions to what Mark Zuckerberg said, to the streetcar story, Carmen Best's appointment, the Dave Minert story. You can tweet at us, at KUOW. Bree Ripley's in the studio monitoring social media, and we'll share any of your thoughts that are something that we should all hear from. It's The Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. With me on Week in Review today, Essex Porter from Cairo TV, former King County executive Ron Sims, and Katie Anthony, a Seattle writer for CNN and NBC News and co-host of the podcast Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory, about family, friend, and other F words. I can't say that enough. It's so hard to say. Democrats have a rare chance to pick up a seat in Congress here in Washington State. The 8th District congressional seat is open since Dave Reichert decided to step down. Republicans have a strong candidate with former state senator and gubernatorial candidate Dino Ross. Do Democrats have a chance? Who should they choose in their next month's primary? Katie Anthony, you live in the 8th District.
I sure do.
Is this Democratic primary very visible to you?
Oh, yeah. When I go to my mailbox every day, it's like I have like 10 mailers. You know, there's signs everywhere. It's great. I love seeing a lot of viable candidates. It really lets us make a choice.
Democratic candidate Jason Rederizer is running a TV ad that goes right at President Trump.
I'm Jason Rederizer. This election is about the future of our democracy. A choice between Trump supporter Dino Rossi or someone who will stand up to this administration. I became a criminal prosecutor to protect people and this country from harm. We just witnessed President Trump denounce American law enforcement and let Russia get away with attacking our nation. Here in Ellensburg, we call that treason. I'm Jason Rederizer. I approve this message to change Congress before it's too late.
Clearly aimed at motivating Democrats, but is this also going to motivate Republicans, particularly in the 8th District? What do you think about that, Ron?
I think that because of the nature of the district, I think that if you have three outstanding Democratic candidates, and I think one of them will be our next member of Congress. Dave Reichert was, in many respects, much more of a moderate than I think Dino Rossi is. But I think that he also had a lot going for him when he got elected, and he maintained that. I think now this is a wide open race, and I think that because of the demographic changes, because of growth, that it's the Democrats' race to lose.
Essex Porter, you've interviewed the Democratic candidates. Would you agree there are three that are going to be in the top tier?
Well, yes, because one of them is, I think Dino Rossi is going to move on to the general,
right.
And one of those three that we talk about, Jason Rederizer, Shannon Hader, Kim Schreier, one of those three will also move on to the general. What strikes me about Rederizer, and I had the opportunity to interview him the day before that ad actually began broadcast, was that he, in our interview, said very much the same thing, that he considered the president's actions tantamount to treason. But then I asked him, if elected, would he move to impeach the president? Mm-hmm. And he backed away from impeachment. He talked about, as a prosecutor, wanting to see all the evidence come in. And that's a bit paradoxical because, you know, treason is one of those crimes that's a death penalty crime, mm-hmm. one of the few federal death penalty crimes. But, if it doesn't rise to the level of impeachment automatically, then you kind of wonder, you know, how the differences are being made. And I think that maybe part of the issue for any of the candidates, because none of the candidates would say they were willing to impeach the president yet, is that on the Republican side, they will use any declaration of wanting to impeach President Trump as a rallying cry for Republicans to come out and defend.
And there's a clear division between Democrats this year. Are they going to call for impeachment or not call for impeachment? How hard are they going to go at that?
Well, not that hard in the 8th District, at least not among the three candidates I interviewed.
Has there been any polling that any of you have heard of? Do we know who's kind of ahead in the Democratic primary?
There was some polling, but it can be a little difficult to interpret. I think... You know, Schreier has more money, has been on the air a few days longer. So, you know, she might be considered to be the narrow front runner.
You know, I looked at Dino Rossi's webpage. I didn't notice any mention of Donald Trump at all. Is Dino Rossi saying anything about his party's leader? Is he going to be able to kind of slide away from the unpopularity of President Trump in this race, in the general election? What do you think, Katie?
Well, he did recently release a statement saying that he was glad that the president clarified his remarks to make sure that everyone understood that he meant that he couldn't see why Russia wouldn't be responsible.
How mild can you get?
Yeah, exactly. I think... what I'm hoping to see in Democratic candidates is like a learning curve to see that we've evolved past the mistakes that we made in 2016, which was to have a reactive media cycle where Trump does something and we all talk about how awful it was, and then we move on to the next awful thing Trump has done, and then we all talk about how awful it was. I want to see these candidates speaking to issues in the district that particularly affect voters who have not been heard and represented before. There are kind of two different ways. I mean, there are a lot more than two, but there are two kind of primary approaches as we're looking at the midterms. One is to try to win back undecideds, and the other is to try to activate disenfranchised voters who, like, their votes have never actually made a measurable difference in their lives. And one of the reasons that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was so successful is that she hustled and she was able to represent a population that has not necessarily been represented in elected office before. So that's what I want to see from these candidates. I want to see healthcare.
Ron says he thinks this will be the year that the Democrats take the 8th district. I'm curious what the other two of you think about that. A lot of challenges over the years to Dave Reichert. Some came close, some fell far apart from it. Katie, it's your district. What do you think?
Well, my district is huge. It should be said. I mean, the 8th is huge. You know, it's Snoqualmie all the way to Ellensburg, across the mountains. I think it's really difficult to kind of have your finger on the pulse there. I would say that Rossi is a canny navigator of the political minefield and is well-funded. You know, I was looking on opensecrets.org, which publishes campaign finance information. And, you know, he's extremely well funded by a number of financial institutions and PACs. And, you know, he is going to be a tough candidate to beat in some ways. But his closeness to Trump, I think, will be a liability if the Democratic candidate can come out and say, like, what about the Affordable Care Act? What about access to health care? What about our schools?
Finally today, are any of you fans of that show, The Americans, about Russian spies planted in the U.S.?
Yes.
Well, a story straight out of The Americans. Prosecutors have arrested Maria Butina, a Russian national, and accused her of being part of a conspiracy to infiltrate American political networks. And Butina has a Northwest connection, Alan Gottlieb from the Bellevue-based Second Amendment Foundation. The accused Russian agent approached Gottlieb to see if her group, Russian group Right to Arms, could join a coalition with the Second Amendment Foundation. Gottlieb attended a conference, a guns rights conference in Moscow. You spoke to Gottlieb about this, Essex. What's his reaction to this revelation that he was consorting with a Russian agent?
You know, he laughs and is as surprised as everyone else that the sliver of international spotlight falls right squarely in his office in Bellevue. His answer to her when she wanted to join his international Right to Bear Arms coalition was, of course, yes, it's an international coalition. She then invited him and his wife to Moscow for her convention, her conference in Moscow on the Right to Bear Arms, introduced him. He spoke. He says that they paid their way, that she never tried to infiltrate anything. She never offered any money to the Second Amendment Foundation. And it struck me that he seemed quite sympathetic to her. You know, she is now in jail, held without bail, accused of failing to register as a foreign agent. And Gottlieb says, you know, I went to Russia and I spoke for the Right to Bear Arms. Nobody jailed me. And now she is being jailed here for the same thing. And Gottlieb says our government has something to answer for.
But, you know, the most surprising thing about this story to me, there's a gun rights movement in Russia. I'm shocked that the Russian yep. government kind of allows people to have guns.
I put that question to Gottlieb.
What did he say?
He said, no, you don't understand. There are lots of guns in Russia, especially in the rural areas. A lot of people have guns. In Moscow, it's different. The Moscow politicians don't like to see a lot of people with guns, and they dominate the Russian parliament, and that's why it's a fight to allow more arms to be legally held in Russia. But he says, oh, no, there's a gun rights movement in Russia.
I don't know if I believe it, but in some quick Googling around, I believe there is a right to own a gun in Russia, but you do have to have a permit and you do have to go through a background check, at least according to this preliminary information.
Well, you couldn't have a gun rights conference in Moscow unless the Putin government thought it was
exactly,
okay.
Exactly, precisely. I want to thank my guests today, Essex Porter from Cairo TV, former King County Executive Ron Sims, and Katie Anthony. She's a Seattle writer who's written for CNN and NBC News. And also check out her podcast, Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory. It's about F-words. I'll say no more. It's not enough a tease to get you to look at it. Check it out, Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory. Bill Radke's back on Monday. Thanks for being with me this week. I'm Ross Reynolds. The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jim Abrempong, and Allison Bruzek. Sophie Reed and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer, Bree Ripley. I'm Ross Reynolds, wishing you a fabulous weekend.